This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Bahir Azmi, about the 20th anniversary of the opening up of the offshore prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
And we also talk about links between what happened in that prison camp and what happened on January 6th, 1 year ago, with the pro-Trump insurrection at the Capitol.
Today we also discuss the growing and pernicious role played by corporate media in the political direction of the country today.
A good example of this is the media aiding the drive towards war against Russia. You don't hear anybody on the media talking about peace.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The George W. Bush administration used the terrorist attacks on 9/11 to launch his so-called global war on terror. Under the guise of fighting terrorism, Bush illegally invaded two countries, instituted an unlawful dragnet of Arab men and boys in the United States, and opened a sinister prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in January 2002. Nearly 800 men and boys were sent to Guantanamo, where many of them were subjected to torture and cruel treatment and held indefinitely, many without charges, in violation of U.S. and international law. Much of this mistreatment was documented in the Guantanamo files, 779 secret files published in 2011 by WikiLeaks. It was documented as well in the report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The 6,700-page report remains secret, but the 499-page executive summary was published in 2014. By locating the prison in Cuba, Bush sought to preclude any judicial review of the detention of the detainees. Most of them had no connection to terrorism. Locked away in Guantanamo for years, detainees lost hope. The only power they had was to refuse food. Many of them engaged in a hunger strike, but were violently force-fed, a practice that amounts to torture. The widely esteemed lawyer and co-founder of Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, was legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights when the center filed the landmark case of Rasul versus Bush. It went to the Supreme Court, which ruled that Bush could not prevent detainees from challenging the legality of their detention in U.S. courts. But 20 years later, Guantanamo remains open, and 39 men are still being held there. We are fortunate to have Bahir Azmi with us today to discuss Guantanamo and the so-called War on Terror, which continues today with very little pushback from the American public. Bahir Azmi is legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he directs all litigation around issues related to the promotion of civil and human rights. He is also professor of law at Seton Hall University. Bahir Azmi, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Marjorie. Happy to be here.
What was the purpose of the George W. Bush administration opening an offshore military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba?
People have to understand that Guantanamo was never about sort of adjudicating guilt or innocence in any meaningful sense or really even meeting out punishment. It was chosen specifically to sit outside the jurisdiction of U.S. courts so that the system that has been developed, in the words of one ominous DOJ memorandum, would be protected from legal review or judicial review. And that system was one designed to impose a series of brutal, endless, debilitating forms of interrogation and torture so that detainees would become totally dependent on their interrogators and offer up the intelligence that the United States imagined each one of these Muslim detainees would automatically have.
Baher, this is Michael Smith. What kind of torture and cruel treatment was going on there?
The entire gamut. The purpose of the torture and cruel treatment was to develop a form of learned helplessness, you know, a term from traditional psychology where a detainee is broken and feels totally dependent on his captor for anything and everything. It's really sort of deeply diabolical. So beatings, sleep deprivation, other forms of sensory deprivation to deny them an awareness of where they are, where they were, solitary confinement, sexual humiliation, religious humiliation. In the case of one of our clients, Hamid Al-Qahtani, deprived of sensory connections, that he nearly went into a coma.
And this is all not to mention waterboarding, true?
Yeah, so waterboarding happened more frequently by the CIA in secret detention camps in Thailand and all over Europe. All of those CIA detainees were brought to Guantanamo in 2006 following a Supreme Court decision which basically suggested that holding even suspected Al-Qaeda members in secret detention, subjecting them to torture, would constitute a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions and a war crime. So to avoid that continuing an open and notorious war crime, the Bush administration brought them to Guantanamo, where by 2006, because of public scrutiny, the overt forms of torture had largely subsided, though other forms of cruelty persisted, including endless solitary confinement, not to mention the inherent cruelty of indefinite detention without charge or trial.
Okay, Baher, torture is illegal under U.S. and international law. What treaties that the U.S. has ratified and federal statutes outlaw torture? Has anybody been held accountable for the torture and abuse at Guantanamo?
So, yeah, torture is one of the most significant international human rights violations that's universally condemned. It's prohibited by a number of provisions of the Geneva Convention, the Convention on Torture, which the United States ratified, and there are domestic criminal statutes that punish torture as a felony. So the Bush administration lawyers, including John Yoo, who's now a tenured law professor at the University of California and a fellow radical soulmate of John Eastman, the lawyer who supported the insurrection with similarly preposterous legal arguments, John Yoo wrote legal memorandums that were slavishly designed to insulate Bush administration officials from these prohibitions by, you know, basically giving them legal cover and suggesting that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply to these detainees and these other provisions, torture prohibitions, don't apply to U.S. officials in this context. And for those reasons and other political reasons, no one has been held meaningfully accountable, at least of all the architects of this program.
And, of course, under the Geneva Conventions, torture constitutes a war crime,
and the U.S. war crime statute punishes that in addition to the U.S. torture statute.
That's right.
We're speaking with Attorney Baher Azmi, who's the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Baher, why hasn't Guantanamo been closed? It could be shuttered at the stroke of a pen by Biden, couldn't it?
Yes, it hasn't been closed due to some combination of, you know, persistent political failure by the Obama, I mean, I wouldn't say political failure by Trump. He campaigned on keeping it open, and now Biden. And just a failure of political will and judicial cowardice to really implement the legal rights, enforce the legal rights the Supreme Court said these detainees should have. So these twin factors have continue to render all of these Muslim men largely ignored and outside the law. There are 39 men left, and Biden, there's a clear pathway for closing the prison. He's made some obscure gestures to clearing more individuals for release, but as of yet has not engaged in a process that he has to engage in to actually start closing the prison.
You write that the essence of authoritarianism is a flagrant disdain for fundamental human rights. Do you believe this is beyond the pale of U.S. norms and values, that it is exceptional?
So, Marjorie, it's a good question. I think part of this has been a 20-year journey for me in trying to understand Guantanamo. When I first got involved in this work, I and all the other really talented lawyers who were involved in the initial challenges to Guantanamo did paint this as an exceptional institution, one that discarded the rule of law and in its absence relied totally, completely on executive and military will and power and discretion. And that's an essential form of authoritarianism, to deny legal constraint. But over 20 years, I've come to see that while that assessment made sense at the time, it was probably wrong. And, you know, Guantanamo is not, you know, despite it being an island prison, and despite its fundamentally shocking and historically anomalous, you know, values and institutions, it's part of a continuum of American life and American politics, one that completely disregards the other and resorts to total power and a disregard for rights of those that the majority thinks are not entitled to rights, which is why the courts gave up on Guantanamo and why Obama and Biden largely gave up on Guantanamo.
What's the relationship between the opening of Guantanamo prison 20 years ago and what you call, quote, the muscular embrace of the anti-constitutionalism and lawlessness that we know today?
Yeah. Yeah, my sense is, you know, Guantanamo is like the a modern tip of the authoritarian sphere. So first, as I mentioned, there's a whole legal architecture developed to reject really foundational legal constraints and give the executive all the power they needed to prosecute this war on terror and just basically develop what I would call an ideology of a maximal security state, and then the creation of this notion of a homeland tolerating outrages like torture, which would have been unimaginable 30 years ago, but simply sort of acceptable in the mumbled words of Dick Cheney, who's now somehow celebrated as a champion of democracy, who, you know, when he said we will have to go to the dark side and engage in torture. So the toleration of these of outrages and the like torture and creating a legal architecture and a political architecture that gives the executive total power, and also creating, as the Bush administration did, this architect of this like vague alien enemy who is everywhere and nowhere and is existential, I think laid a profound foundation for Trump, who, with respect to, you know, the soft authoritarianism of the Bush administration, produced the hard authoritarianism of the Trump administration. So if we can tolerate outrages like torture, Trump will double down on it, say we have to do more torture. When you create the idea of some existential non-white threat out there, first with respect to Muslims, Trump can say, well, the soft authoritarian didn't do enough to protect us from this threat, so I'm going to double Guantanamo, engage in torture, and then actually ban Muslims from coming into the country. And then very easily shift from one existential threat to another. In the case of Trump, Mexican and Central American immigrants on the southern border. See how easily Trump could toggle from terrorists to rapists, Muslim terrorists to Mexican rapists, and then
ensure that the homeland, which was an abstract construction by the Bush administration, would be fortified by a wall. And so I see a line between January 11th, 2002, issue of the opening of Guantanamo to January 6th, 2021, the insurrection and the total subversion of a basic principle of the rule of law, which is the peaceful transfer of power.
Did the Supreme Court agree with the Bush administration that Guantanamo was beyond the reach of U.S. courts? Please discuss Rasool versus Bush and Boumediene versus Bush.
Yeah, so the Center for Constitutional Rights, led by its former president and, you know, someone this program knows well, renowned anti-imperialist lawyer Michael Ratner, when they learned about the creation of Guantanamo, mobilized to represent detainees held there, although I should say the detainees, of course, had no idea because they were being held incommunicado that they had lawyers. So CCR filed the first petitions for habeas corpus in February of 2002, just months after 9/11, on behalf of a number of British and Australian detainees who CCR had been in touch with through their home human rights lawyers. Lost very quickly in the lower courts, but ultimately the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case in 2004 in Rasool versus Bush and reject the Bush administration's position that they can hold individuals incommunicado and totally outside of the law, and that therefore they would have habeas corpus rights. And thereafter, CCR recruited hundreds and hundreds of lawyers to represent the men there, what one commentator has called one of the greatest mass defense efforts in U.S. history, such that ultimately all 779 men had lawyers from across the entire range of legal practice, big law, academics, federal defenders, solo practitioners, and trying to file writs of habeas corpus and have hearings. At the same time, Congress tried to reverse the Rasool decision twice by stripping the detainees of habeas corpus rights, which led to a second battle in the Supreme Court in 2008 and a decision in the Boumediene case, which said Congress cannot do that. The detainees actually have constitutional rights to access habeas corpus. But even before Boumediene was decided, it was really Rasool that was a key decision in giving clients access to lawyers, because what lawyers could do, even though the courts were formally shut down to actual hearings, lawyers could speak with their clients and tell their stories, and most fundamentally introduce what is anathema to the essence of Guantanamo, introduce hope for their clients. So lawyers started telling hundreds of stories about clients who were now could be individualized rather than some global terrorist mass, as the Bush administration tried to cast them, stories of innocence, stories of torture, stories of administration incompetence, sharing poetry, art, and other forms of resistance. And that put pressure on the administration and changed the entire narrative around Guantanamo, so that by 2002, when CCR was getting death threats for filing these cases, compared to 2008, when there was basically a judicial and political consensus that Guantanamo was illegitimate. That's the work of the storytelling and the resistance of clients and lawyers. Even if the Boumediene decision and the suggestion that they would have constitutional rights ultimately turned out to be toothless, the process of lawyering and resistance and the detainees' own courage is what got most of them out of Guantanamo.
Bahir Azmi, you have a profound insight, one that was shared by the great civil rights attorney William Kunstler. And Kunstler wrote that the Nazis covered what they were doing with a legal blanket. Everything they did seemingly was legal. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're reluctant, or have been reluctant, to sort of really appreciate the authoritarian cast of the Bush administration, what I call the soft authoritarianism that led to the Trump's hard authoritarianism, because it had the veneer of law. But all authoritarian systems have law. The Soviet Union had law. Nazi Germany had law. A apartheid South Africa had law and apartheid Jim Crow South had law. But it's a kind of law that simply relies on the maximizing the authority of the state without the kind of substantive and meaningful jurisprudential and moral principles of law that's supposed to guide a true constitutional republic. So everything the Bush administration did was papered by lawyers in the highest places of the Justice Department, including John Yoo, I believe is functionally a war criminal. But that shouldn't mask the authoritarian instinct that's driving these entities to cover their work with legal process.
You write about the, quote, Bush administration's broader portrayal of a mysterious conspiratorial enemy that lured everywhere in the shadows with unbridled hatred and power, collapsing a vast world religion into an Oriental caste, one according to which all adherents have a presumptive ideological commitment to evil, unquote. Discuss, please, how the detainees were demonized.
Yeah, I think it became very important for the Bush administration to conjure this very serious existential threat out there, and people were naturally terrified, even as there were sort of thin gestures that Islam itself is not evil. The Bush administration was talking regularly about the evil of Islamic terrorism. So Guantanamo served a useful iconographic purpose by showing the public that despite what people might have thought was a catastrophic failure to protect the country from what was an anticipatable, apparently, attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, to sort of deflect from that and show their strength, that was one of the purposes of Guantanamo. And we can see that in early leaked photos that generally violate the Geneva Convention of, you know, hooded and prone Muslim men chained together on a C-17 transport plane like cattle or freight, and then prostrate Muslim men hooded and chained in the open air of the cages in Camp X-Ray started in 2002. So here they were showing the world at the same time this menacing enemy that was now under control in Guantanamo, and that certainly served its purpose as well. And all of these sort of extra legal mechanisms, including the idea that the Geneva Convention, which applied to the Nazi menace in World War II, would not apply to these individuals, was part of a project to show that all of this power was necessary because the other is upon us. And that's a formula that's very old in U.S. history. Did not start with Guantanamo. It started, you can say, in 1619, and in the same formula of genocide and dispossession of natives and the exploitation of black people who were enslaved, et cetera, et cetera. But very, very acutely focused in this 20-year period, which the Trump administration built on, within their view, such clarity and force. An other that needs to be stamped out. And the other was expanded, not just to Muslims, why would it be, but to other existential threats like immigrants and people of color.
We're speaking with attorney Bahir Azmi, who's the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bahir had a marvelous, very important article in the Boston Review a couple of weeks ago. We'll link to that article. The essence of the article is the connection between Guantanamo and 20 years later, the insurrection on January 6th at the Capitol. Bahir, what about the profoundly dismaying willingness of the American public that went along with what was going on? Why do you think that white people feel safer and freer when they dominate the other?
Yeah, so that's a dominant theme in American history, dominant strain, I would say, which is not to say all Americans subscribe to it. It's the principle that was at the heart of genocide and disposition of natives, at the heart of the practice of enslaving millions of black people, which were connected practices. And it's the formula to sort of construct and conjure a threat or a inferiority of non-white people, and then achieve a sense of freedom or liberation from dominating them. That's the, you know, a version of Adam Serwer's point about sort of progressive or polite society's shock at the Trump administration's cruelty. Serwer said the cruelty is the point, by which, you know, I think he means, and I'd agree, there is not just a, it's not just a sort of temporary compromise of liberty that people are tolerating. There can be actual sense of freedom, of liberation from repressing others, and reinforcing your superior status. And I believe that was part of the messaging subtext of the Bush administration in the early years of Guantanamo, which I would say worked only for a little bit until stories of the individuals there who could reject the sort of totalizing framework of a, you know, Muslim threat, stories started coming out that undermined those narratives. And in so undermining those narratives, undermined the project of Guantanamo. It became illegitimate. And despite its resilience, it is now, it just occupies the strange dual space of something that's universally and historically condemned, yet something that persists. And my thinking is it persists not because, as we once thought, it was exceptional. It persists because it really sits at the heart of so many kind of repressive strands in American political life.
Did torture take place during the Obama administration? Does the force feeding of hunger strikers constitute torture? And what about torture by the Trump administration? Now the Biden administration is claiming that torture by U.S. forces and their mercenaries is a state secret.
The Obama administration ended the Bush administration's practice of overt torture. They did respond to mass hunger strikes, not with by accommodating what was at the heart of them, which is a profound injustice, but by doubling down on really cruel force feeding. I think it's an open question if that meets the legal definition of torture. Our client certainly experienced it as torture and degradation. You know, I'm not aware of whether or not the Trump administration engaged in overt forms of torture, probably not at Guantanamo. But throughout, the reflex of the U.S. government is to classify this as a secret. The Bush administration, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, now the Biden administration, they want to keep as much as possible U.S. practices a secret and are relying on, you know, almost Soviet show trial forms of dissembling to classify what would otherwise be known, otherwise known as public, still a state secret, such that cases seeking accountability for torture, for example, in the case of Abu Zubaydah, the first CIA torture victim, could be shut down and taken out of the courts because of some fantastic harm to national security.
Bahir, finally, was the January 6th insurrection an exception? You say that our task now is not so much to protect democracy as to build it. How can we do that?
Yes, I mean, it was a horrific and sort of terrifying and chilling process, but our democratic institutions have been so thinned and so frayed. So my goal was to suggest it's not as exceptional as we think. There are strains from Guantanamo before that produce it, namely around white supremacist entitlement to power, rather than ceding, as democracies do, power to other people, and considering your losses in the political process as legitimate. The white supremacist dominant framework in this country, dominated particularly by the Republican Party and the conservative movement, rejects democracy. So we have to build it. We have to build it through resistance in the court and building power among communities and organizers, and voting power for these constituencies that is protected by legitimate and strengthened democratic institutions, like the courts, the Congress, local legislatures, community groups, and grassroots groups.
Bahir, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Marjorie and I appreciate immensely your good work. Before we say goodbye, can you tell us how people can follow you and the work of the CCR?
Sure. The best way to follow us is to go to ccrjustice.org. You can read about our work, you can sign up for newsletters, and of course, we'd welcome any support people are interested in offering us.
Thank you so much, Bahir, for this terrific and important interview.
Thank you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
And now we take a look at the current role of corporate mainstream media, the role it plays in America today, in particular the increasing power and danger of the right-wing media. And to do so, we're very fortunate to have as our guest for this topic, Jeff Cohn. Jeff Cohn is a highly regarded progressive critic of the media. Indeed, he was recently quoted in an important article in the Washington Post about the disclosure that Fox News hosts were advising the White House during the January 6th insurrection. Jeff Cohn, along with Martin Lee, were the co-founders of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, which is the anti-corporate media group that monitors and reports on the mainstream media's biases, spins, and misinformation. Jeff Cohn is also a lecturer on these matters and the author of the book, Cable News Confidential. I've known Jeff for many years now, and I can say without fear of contradiction that no one really has done more valuable work in monitoring and challenging the all too, well, pernicious role played by the corporate media in America than Jeff Cohn. So, Jeff Cohn, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Jeff, let's talk a bit about your own experience within the corporate media. Because before the Iraq War, you were that rare commodity, a progressive media critic who got the chance to have an insider's look at the corporate media due to your work with Phil Donahue. But then, shortly before the Iraq War started, your career ended when both you and Donahue were terminated at MSNBC for what you believe were political reasons, right?
Yeah, it's not just my belief. A document leaked out the day after we were terminated, an internal NBC document, and it read that Donahue represents, quote, a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. He seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives, unquote. And then the document went on to say, to express their fear that Donahue would be, quote, the home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. There's no doubt that we were canned because we were trying to do journalism at MSNBC on the primetime Phil Donahue show. They tried to muzzle us for months. We kept trying to put on experts and guests who challenged all the myths that were not being challenged on the front page of the New York Times. They weren't being challenged on the op-ed pages of the Washington Post or the editorial pages, but we were trying to challenge the mythology. you know, once we booked a UN weapons inspector, a former inspector, who said there's no weapons of mass destruction threat from Iraq. He turned out to be 100% correct, but we couldn't get him on the air unless he was balanced by someone who sort of outshouted him from the pro-war perspective. And then we booked Ramsey Clark, who gave a very articulate critique of why it would be a disaster and illegal to invade Iraq, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. And we were told the next morning that we'd really screwed up by MSNBC management. We'd really screwed up because Ramsey Clark is never supposed to appear on this channel. Now, remember, I'm talking about the events right before the invasion of Iraq. I'm talking about the end of 2002, not 1952, when we had the blacklist, the McCarthyite blacklist. So it was a continuous struggle for us to try to do journalism at MSNBC about war when hopefully journalism, good journalism, could have prevented that war that has been such a disaster for the people of Iraq, the people of the region, and the U.S. soldiers who were sent over. It's been a disaster, but we weren't allowed to do that. And MSNBC, after they got rid of Phil Donahue, they got rid of me, they picked up the flag and just started waving it. You can't do your job as a journalist if you're expending so much energy waving the flag.
Jeff, the right-wing media seems to grow stronger all the time, and it's been doing so for at least the last 20, 25 years. What accounts for the rise and increasing influence of right-wing media, and just how powerful and influential is it today?
Yeah, right-wing media has never been this influential. It's been growing for decades. It started with the right-wing takeover of talk radio with Rush Limbaugh in the 80s and 90s, and then Fox News formed at the end of the 90s, and you also have now One America News, which is to the right of Fox, and Newsmax, which is to the right of Fox, and you have all these extreme websites. You have so-called social media that feeds misinformation to the already misinformed through algorithms, as the corporations that own those social media platforms are getting rich. But yes, it's a huge threat. And what people don't understand is the history of media policy in our country, because the biggest jump, the biggest building of right-wing media in our country can be attributed to President Bill Clinton, the Democrat, working hand-in-hand with the Republican Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, when they shoved through the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which allowed big corporations, media corporations, to grow even bigger. So you had Rupert Murdoch was able to use that act to build the Fox empire. The right-wing company in Texas, allied with Rush Limbaugh, called Clear Channel, was allowed to become the biggest radio company in the country. Today, one of the most pro-Trump media companies is Sinclair Broadcasting. And prior to the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that President Bill Clinton is so responsible for, Sinclair was only allowed under law to own 12 local TV channels, TV stations in the whole country. Now they own or operate almost 200. And polls show that the, you know, the public trusts local TV news more than other news sources. So when I see the threat of fascism today, and you see polls showing that so many right-wingers believe that violence may be necessary to defend their beliefs and, quote, save their country, this threat of fascism has a key cog in that threat has been the growth of right-wing media, and I blame Democrats and Republicans, and especially middle-of-the-road media conglomerates.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, is it fair to say that the mainstream media's political span is politically limited today? I mean, limited in that it extends only from the far right to the corporate centrist media like CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times, for that matter. And I'm thinking in this regard that we now have this crisis with Ukraine, the United States, and Russia, and the mainstream media is certainly not providing any debate to the listening audience or the viewing audience on that issue. It's all from one point of view, and it's at best a centrist point of view.
I so agree with what you just said, and FAIR has been documenting this for decades now, that the media spectrum goes from GE to GM, you know, General Electric to General Motors, from corporate center to corporate right. And, you know, I traveled around Western Europe in the year before I started FAIR, and it's partly why I started FAIR, is I saw in Western European countries, which are where television is dominated by strong public television channels, that voices of peace groups, voices of labor groups, voices of environmental groups, left-wing organizations, they're included sometimes in Western European media discussions and debates. In our country, they're systematically excluded. So, you know, FAIR did its famous study in the run-up to the Iraq invasion when I was over at MSNBC, and FAIR studied the four most powerful, the four biggest TV news shows, including the public TV news hour, and they looked at every single source who was allowed to comment on whether to invade Iraq or not. And this was 1 week before, 1 week after Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations that was so full of misinformation about the Iraqi weapons threat. And out of 393 sources on these four TV news shows, only three were anti-war advocates. That's a fraction of 1%. So today, we have this crisis on the Ukraine-Russia border. And I keep looking for a dissenting view. It may be worse than the run-up to Iraq. It's one war hawk after another. There's no background given on why Russia or Putin may be paranoid about Ukraine. There's absolutely no dissent allowed. There are no debates about the crisis. And, of course, the history of how we got to this crisis is very rich. And one of the most important pieces of this history is that when the Soviet Union was dissolving after the two Germanies had unified and the Berlin Wall had fallen, in one guarantee after another, United States top leaders, President Bush, President Clinton, Secretary of State Baker, Secretary of Defense Gates, they all went to Gorbachev. This is all well documented through declassified documents. They went to Gorbachev. They went to Yeltsin. They said, NATO will never expand eastward. The famous comment from Baker to Gorbachev, the Secretary, U.S. Secretary of State, not one inch eastward. And yet, over the years, we've had, you know, the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet bloc, fell apart, and seven former members or more of the Soviet bloc join NATO. Three former Soviet republics are in NATO. And when Russia says, and it's considered absolutely absurd in U.S. media, well, who would ever consider that? When Russia says, we don't want Ukraine yet to on our border to join NATO, which is, after all, a military alliance. It's an alliance of soldiers and weaponry. And, you know, the Warsaw Pact was the military alliance on the other side in the Cold War. It no longer exists. So this idea that why is Russia paranoid, it's not asked. Why is Russia having this backlash? Why are they so furious? Why are they amassing troops on the Ukraine border? There's never any context given. And so it's just, you know, the jingoism. And right now, the U.S. is rushing $500 in military funding assistance to Ukraine. Pelosi's pushing it through. And that would mean that after Israel and Egypt, Ukraine would be number three in military assistance. And, you know, in a democracy, and I learned this when I was at MSNBC in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, that it's never more important, if you are a democracy, to have debates about major issues, especially on the eve of war. That's when you really need a robust debate, and that's exactly when the U.S. media shuts down all pretense of debate.
We're talking with Jeff Cohn from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Jeff, you wrote an article where you cite as an example of the centrist bias of the corporate media how the media regularly calls Biden's Build Back Better proposal massive, whereas the much, much larger Pentagon budget authorization bill sailed through Congress without the centrist media calling it massive. How common are such examples?
Oh, totally common. The prestige media, the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, they're heard. They affix this scary adjective, massive, to the Build Back Better proposal, which at its peak was going to be $3.5 trillion over 10 years. That's $350 billion a year. And then Senator Manchin cut it down in half to $175 billion a year. And centrist outlets were still calling it massive at that point. The reality, as you said, is that the military budget, half of all U.S. discretionary spending goes to the military. And the military budget this year, the Pentagon budget alone, $768 billion, not scrutinized by the prestige middle-of-the-road media, not scrutinized even after, you know, one of the few boasts from Trump that was actually true is I built up the military budget year after year. Even after that last bloated military budget from Trump, Biden requested $12 billion more, but that wasn't enough for the bipartisan leadership of Congress led by Speaker Pelosi. They added $25 billion on top of that. And mainstream media just did not scrutinize a bill that dwarfed Build Back Better two, three, four times. So these middle-of-the-road outlets who kept calling Build Back Better massive, you know, they would have needed to affix a pronoun, an adjective like gargantuan or ginormous, they were going to describe the military budget bill, but they didn't, and it received no scrutiny, virtually no scrutiny, and that's where the corruption really was, in continuously padding the U.S. military budget.
Indeed. Jeff, it's always good whenever possible, and it's not possible all that often these days, to insert some good news into the story we're discussing. I do know, though, you and I have talked about this in the past, that you think there is some good news where the media is concerned. And, of course, what it has to do with is the growth of progressive, non-conglomerate, independent media outlets over the last 20 years on the Internet and so forth. How big a dent has that made in the overall influence of corporate media, because they've expanded that way, too? And can we expect it to continue to grow in the years ahead?
Yes, we can expect it to grow as long as we keep net neutrality, which allows the Internet to be free. And it prevents Comcast, Verizon, AT&T from taking websites like Democracy Now! And shoving them into the slow lane. The Internet is a double-edged sword. Obviously, with social media and the Internet, the right wing has used it brilliantly. But without the Internet, there wouldn't have been this boom in independent journalist-oriented media, progressive media, non-conglomerated media. Today, if you add up Democracy Now!, Salon.com, Common Dreams, Truth Out, The Young Turks, you put it all together, and millions of people are able to get their news from journalists whose work is not constrained by corporate owners or corporate sponsors. And that's a new thing in U.S. history. When I was at Ithaca College, I taught and studied independent media. You know, the two previous times there was a real growth of independent media, non-corporate controlled media. One was the big socialist press before World War I, and two was the rise of the New Left and the alternative press and the underground weeklies in the late 60s and 70s. But in those eras, people had to wait a week to get, like, I.F. Stone's Weekly, or to get the L.A. Free Press or the Village Voice or whatever. Today, you can get independent news every hour of the day. So, obviously, it's under-resourced compared to the corporate centrist media and compared to the right-wing media, but it really has been a boom. And if people care about the possibility of challenging bias and exclusion and censorship in corporate centrist and corporate right-wing media, then they have to support Pacifica Radio, community radio, and independent websites and outlets, because that's the only way. Those outlets don't have millions of dollars in marketing budgets that Rupert Murdoch does for Fox, or that Comcast does for MSNBC, or AT&T, which owns CNN. They have huge marketing budgets on the independent progressive media sector, which is growing. All they have is word of mouth.
Yeah, that leads me to something that Jim and I hadn't thought to ask you, but I think we should. How profitable are these corporate media giants? What kind of money do they generate for their stockholders?
Huge. The only thing that's been suffering is the profit margins of daily newspapers, and they've been just cutting off staff to keep making it profitable. And that's why newspapers get thinner and thinner. But most of the media, they're hugely profitable. And the sad thing is, a lot of liberals and progressives, they don't even know who owns the media. I mean, CNN is owned by AT&T. MSNBC is owned by Comcast. Those two companies were working hand in glove with Trump to try to do away with net neutrality and eliminate freedom on the internet. And most of the public doesn't know it. These giant conglomerates, Disney owns ABC, these giant conglomerates are making huge profits. Our media, unlike, say, Western European television and radio, our media have always been overly commercialized, controlled by corporate owners and sponsors. So we have a media system that's very good at selling things, not so good at telling truths.
You know, Jeff, following up on Mike's last point about the sacredness of profits, makes me want to ask you this question then, I guess. This is a capitalist country. You've pointed out just how monopolized the corporate media is in the country today, the growing monopoly, really, of it. So long as that is the situation, so long as this is a capitalist nation and such, when, if ever, can we expect to see the day when honest, non-biased mainstream media is the rule rather than the exception? Will the internet and alternative radio, such as Pacifica Radio, be all that more necessary? But will it be anywhere near enough if we're going to win the fight for peace and social justice with still capitalism dominating the scene with respect to the media and, well, everything else?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you really need to support independent, non-corporate media. Remember, Western European countries are largely capitalist countries, but they still have powerful public broadcasting. And yes, journalists on public broadcasting in other countries are not so controversy-averse as they are in our country. So there are ways of even, you know, if we had a president like Bernie Sanders, or we had some a bigger and bigger progressive squad, you could restructure U.S. media so that journalists could do their jobs. But like in our country, when you look at how much money goes to public broadcasting and compare it to how much money in other advanced countries goes to public broadcasting, like in Germany, Scandinavian countries, it's about $140 per person goes to public broadcasting. In Britain, it's about $110. That's the BBC. In Spain and Japan, it's only $50 per person. Canada, the CBC, it's only $30 per person. In our country, it's $3 per person. And into that vacuum, the reason public broadcasting is so disappointing, where it's so important in other Western countries, you know, when you're only got $3 of tax money per person going to public broadcasting, what floods into that vacuum is corporate sponsors, or what they're politely called corporate underwriters, and they often have undue influence on which public television shows go on the air and which stay on the air. So PBS has always had a lot of business shows and Wall Street shows. They've never had a labor union show. They've never had a consumer rights show. They've never had an environmental rights show. You can restructure our system through some reforms where you would break up media monopolies, you would create public broadcasting for the first time in our country, and there's a way of getting taxpayers to set off $150, $200 that could go to any nonprofit news outlet of their choice. And that's a reform that would get millions of dollars toward Pacifica, toward Common Dreams, toward Truth Out, toward Democracy Now. There are ways we can have reforms. There's a whole agenda of reforms that could restructure our media in a more democratic and diverse way.
Well, Jeff Cohn, before we have to say goodbye, and this has been amazing, and I wish we could continue, let our listeners know where to find these days Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It's still doing an amazing job. And how they could perhaps get a copy of your book, Cable News Confidential.
I found it Fair. I haven't been there, but they have a great staff. Everyone should go to fair.org, F-A-I-R.org. You can sign up at the upper right of the homepage and start getting some of this data and some of these reports. My book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, you could find it online, and you can go to my personal website with all my articles, jeffcohen.org.
On behalf of Michael and myself, right, Mike, it's been wonderful talking to you.
Fan of Jeff Cohen's for many years.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us on Law and Disorder.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.